from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning at 9, we find out about the battles against Al-Qaeda with New York Times national security reporter Eric Schmidt, who, along with his co-author Tom Shanker, recently published Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. Then at 9:30, we'll discuss the significance of the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which is officially over today after 18 years of being the law of the land. What will it mean to have gays and lesbians in the military open about their sexuality? Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. New York Times national security correspondent and terrorism reporter Eric Schmidt joins us in studio for this Forum half-hour segment to discuss America's response to Al-Qaeda post-9/11. His book, co-authored with fellow New York Times security correspondent Tom Shanker, is called Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. And we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you. A lot of this is classified intelligence that you've managed to get your hands on and bring forward in the book. And I wanted to begin by talking about Yemen and the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is, of course, located in Yemen now, and getting large quantities, apparently, of castor beans, which are used in the production of ricin for small explosives. This was actually a plan that Americans got a hold of, or American intelligence got a hold of, from the Saudis directly.
That's right, Michael. What this was a plot, and it again shows how the threat from Al-Qaeda is not only from the tribal areas of Pakistan, where the headquarters of Al-Qaeda has long been, but these growing affiliates, in this case the affiliate in Yemen. And what we learned from talking to intelligence officials was that this Al-Qaeda affiliate was trying to buy up big quantities of castor beans. And from castor beans, you grind them up and you make into a deadly poison called ricin. And the plot, as it was described to us, that was unfolding early last year, at least they were watching this, was how Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula would try and wrap these poisons essentially inside of small explosives and take them and perhaps use them in shopping centers or other enclosed spaces, airports or something like that, and create weapons of terror, essentially what they are.
All too reminiscent of what was done in Japan with the sarin nerve gas along those lines. But these would be presumably lone wolves and maybe even people who were, well, conscripted off of the internet, like has been done presumably by Anwar al-Awlaki.
That's right. It could be those. Those are, of course, the American-born cleric who is now in hiding in Yemen, whose online videos have radicalized several American citizens, including the shooter down at Fort Hood, Major Nadan. Nadal Hassan. But there will also be agents of Al-Qaeda in Yemen who are bomb makers extraordinaire, who, if they could master this, and there are many vulnerabilities to this plot. Yemeni ricin is a very sensitive type of powdery agent. If exposed to extreme heat, its potency can be lessened. And so there are hurdles for this kind of
bomb to be
successful. It's very hot in Yemen.
And dry,
exactly.
Which is not necessarily good for this. But it's hard. I mean, there are difficulties in deploying this. The fact is, though, that there was a plot in works. And weren't they also trying to put ricin into perfume bottles and send them?
Yes. This was another plot that was they actually advertised in some of their online propaganda, that they would try and put essentially poisons inside of some of these perfumes and colognes, and of course, which are very popular throughout the Middle East. This is something, again, that's very hard to master. So again, it's something that American intelligence operatives are watching closely. They haven't yet seen it.
Well, American operatives are getting information from, shipboard interrogation of Somali terrorists, according to your book, from the Saudis, from what's left of Yemen, and they're doing a much better job. I mean, one of the things that 9/11 set in motion, really, at least one feels almost uplifted in some ways reading your book, because there's greater surveillance and monitoring, greater intelligence, of course, the killing of bin Laden, better informants and trailing financing and so forth, but there's still that sense of this ideology that's out there, and these lone wolves and people mm-hmm. just trying to strike with no address.
That's right. As you mentioned, Michael, there has been great improvements in what we call in our book the whole of government approach to combating terrorism, whether it's not just the military and intelligence communities, but it's the FBI and diplomats and even the Treasury Department, which is cracking down on the financing networks for terrorists. But as you identify, one of the weaknesses of the American government is trying to combat the ideology. And it's an ideology of al-Qaeda. It's quite simple but effective. It says that the West is at war with Islam. And how do you combat that? It's very hard for the U.S. to do that because it doesn't have much credibility on the street. So they're looking for credible Muslim voices in these countries to help combat the narrative of al-Qaeda is still espousing.
Also doing a pretty good job of propaganda, according to your book. I mean, when the Taliban blind schoolgirls with acid and that sort of thing, it makes quick dissemination into the news organs.
That's right. They're oftentimes very nimble in terms of they get this information out and in terms of putting out disinformation. The United States, of course, is limited, at least in its public statements, to putting out only truthful information, having to rely on some covert operations to disseminate false information. What we write about in our book, for instance, is how intelligence operatives are going online, which is really one of the safe havens, Michael, for terrorists. It's where they recruit. It's where they raise money. And so Arabic-speaking analysts are infiltrating some of these militant chat rooms and raising questions and dissent in these ranks. They're also hacking into terrorist leaders' cell phones and sending out false messages to all the brethren to again, sow confusion in the ranks. So while there are lots of bombs and bullets still flying, there are other ways of trying to get inside the heads of terrorists and dissuade them from attacking.
We're talking to Eric Schmidt, senior writer and terrorism and national security correspondent for the New York Times and co-author of a new book called Counterstrike. You talked to some intelligence expert from defense who said the only way that maybe we're going to defeat al-Qaeda, and despite some higher-ups getting killed and the drones and all of this and people speaking optimistically, is to have it implode like communism did.
That's right. What we argue in this book is that al-Qaeda and other its affiliates and terrorism in general is very resilient and that there will be another attack. Now, it may not be on the scale of 9/11, hope. It may be a smaller-scale attack, which is what al-Qaeda is now pressing for. But the United States and its allies have to be good and lucky all the time. The terrorists only have to be good and lucky every once in a while. So the question is the country going to be resilient enough, not just in rebuilding infrastructure that may be damaged, but psychologically resilient so that when there is another attack, there's not an overreaction to it, which is exactly what the terrorists would like.
Well, you mentioned Pakistan before, and of course, there's a lot happening in Yemen and Somalia because those governments are so shaky and fragile, and there's kind of ease at setting up bases there and the like. But in Pakistan, you've got usable fuel in Pakistan. You've also got people from Pakistan going into Yemen, and you've got all of the no man's land of Pakistan, which is probably pretty still strongly pervasive with terrorists.
Absolutely. Even with all the drone strikes that have been carried out, and there's been an escalation of those strikes under President Obama from President Bush, Pakistan still remains a very dangerous place, not just because of al-Qaeda, but because of a whole network of other groups, including the group, the so-called Haqqani Network, that is probably responsible for the attack in Kabul just last week. So there are a number of different militant groups, both Pashtun, Kashmiri-based, that are really combining together now to form a real witch's brew of terrorist operations there.
And what about all these regional affiliates? I mean, they're looking for Western recruits, as I intimated before, mm-hmm. and as you pretty much point out in your book. They're looking, in fact, for people who don't look like, I suppose they could be racially identified in any way or right. ethnically identified.
If you go back to this, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen that we were speaking about before, the so-called underpants bomber, the young Nigerian man in Christmas of 2009 who tried to blow himself up on a plane over Detroit. Here was a young Nigerian man. He'd had visas to come to the United States. He'd studied in England. He was exactly the kind of individual that al-Qaeda was looking for, who could slip in and blend in with a very cosmopolitan international crowd and not necessarily be picked out by any type of screeners.
Did you read the New Yorker account of the assassination of bin Laden?
I did. It was quite good. Yeah.
Yeah, do you think so? Because there's a lot of controversy about the accuracy of it, yeah. The genuine reportage. What's your take on that?
It's one of these things. I know the author quite well. He's a very good reporter. And, of course, there are always going to be doubts until you can get to the bottom and speak to the Navy SEALs themselves. They have not spoken individually to reporters. So we've been pulling both for our book and for the New Yorker article, pulling on accounts of those who've been briefed, who've sat down with many of the Navy SEALs and have done that. But this was one of the real success stories. If you look back, and many of the top leaders, including former Secretary Bob Gates, told us this was simply not an attack, a raid that could have happened on 9/11 itself. The government wasn't organized to be able to do this. You didn't have the kind of cooperation between the CIA and the Special Operations Commandos that you did in that operation. And the networks of intelligence that were overhead, from the networks of informers on the ground to overhead satellites. They had a spy drone above, basically watching that compound for months before the raid was actually carried out. It was unprecedented, really.
Again, we're talking to Eric Schmitz, senior writer and terrorism and national security correspondent for The New Yorker and co-author of Counterstrike. I'm going to open the phone lines now and invite those of you listening to join us if you have questions or comments. This is a half-hour segment, so if you'd like to join the conversation, the time to do it would be now. Our toll-free number is available whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us now with any questions or comments you might have at 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. Of course, you can also make a comment on our Facebook page. The book is Counterstrike, the Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda, and it goes into detail not only about what happened after 9/11, but what is really pretty current for that matter. And speaking about current, I was kind of alarmed when I heard that in Libya, there were some surface-to-air missiles that seemed to have come under the control of some of the rebels. Alarmed because many of these were the same rebels who went to fight with al-Qaeda in Iraq.
That's right. There is a big question now as to how many of these former Islamist fighters in Libya may now turn against the new civilian government that is forming in Libya. Many of these, the Libyan fighting group members, have said they are not aligned with al-Qaeda anymore, and they're going to be supporting the new government there. But it's still yet to be seen how that unfolds. And as you point out, there are these SA-7 missiles that have gone missing, very dangerous to aircraft, and are now, whether they're in the hands of terrorists or not, they're certainly out in the black market, available for the highest bidder.
Getting back to Yemen for a moment, CIA is building a base in Yemen?
It's not Yemen specifically. It's going to be in the region somewhere. And of course, the CIA won't say exactly where that is, but close by. And this is to basically build up a capability to allow them to carry out the same kind of drone strikes that they've been doing in Pakistan. This really reflects a weakness in the administration's policy in that they have been trying to build up the security forces in countries like Yemen, Somalia, which really doesn't have a very effective working government. And when those efforts fail, as they're doing pretty much now in Yemen with the government there collapsing, the ultimate kind of last tool or resort is these drone strikes to kind of whack away at some of the senior terrorist leaders that they believe are operating there.
Well, it's pretty chaotic in both Yemen and Somalia, mm-hmm. and it makes for a possibility of what happened in Afghanistan being replicated, or at least in a smaller scale, if mm-hmm. Indeed al-Qaeda's leadership has been seriously injured and hampered, as we keep reading. And what about, just to talk about Somalia for a minute, with the ties with Shabaab?
Yeah, that's another interesting thing, Michael, because as you look at Shabaab as an Islamist group that operates there, so far it's been, with the exception of one attack in Kampala, Uganda, during the World Cup, it is focused mainly on attacking the government, the transitional government that's in Mogadishu. So one of the tensions in the United States administration is, how hard do we attack Shabaab, which right now is not necessarily focused on attacking the United States, but certainly will be if we carry out a large number of strikes, not against only its senior leaders, but against many of the followers that are training in its training camps. And of course, there's a fairly large Somali-American community here. Somalis have gone from Minneapolis. More than 20 young men have left Minneapolis, for instance, to go to Somalia and fight there. So there's a concern of how aggressively do you take on an organization like that with military might, again, and maybe suffer the consequences. So they're trying to do other means of combating that group as well.
And almost in a way parallels the concern about the Taliban. I mean, to what extent is the Taliban continuing to ally itself with al-Qaeda? And, one point, course, we supported the Taliban against the Mujahideen in the fight against the Soviet Union during the Cold War. So these things are constantly in a different kind of shifting situation.
Constantly shifting, yeah. Very fluid. And as you point out, in the Taliban, there are now these talks underway with kind of shadowy talks of trying to reconcile some of the Taliban leaders who might come in from out of the cold and work with remnants of the Karzai government there. The big question is, if the Taliban were ever to take over again, or either large parts of the entire country, would al-Qaeda be allowed back in? The Taliban say, no, we've learned that lesson. We won't let them in. But American officials are obviously quite skeptical of those claims.
Let me bring our callers in, and we go first, Casey, to you. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me on. I had a couple questions. The first one is, the gentleman just said that the Osama bin Laden assassination wouldn't have been possible on 9/11. And I've heard several times that a couple of presidents, I think Clinton sticks in my mind, had the opportunity to do it. I just don't think that's true. I think that's kind of a sales pitch for our government and what it's doing in the Middle East right now. And then secondly, I'd like to hear them talk more about the difference between al-Qaeda and people who live in Afghanistan and do not want us running their country and are willing to defend their country with violence, which I don't necessarily hold them responsible for doing that. If someone tried to take over my country, I'm not sure I wouldn't be in that same position.
The caller is correct that the U.S. did have opportunities to kill bin Laden many years ago. What I was speaking of specifically was the kind of raid that the SEALs carried out, a very coordinated raid involving CIA, Special Operations Community, intelligence operators on the ground.
Bill Clinton could have killed bin Laden.
There was at least a possibility if they'd been able to carry out a drone strike. Now, there was, you know, whether that would have been effective or not. As for the Taliban, of course, there are many people in Afghanistan now who simply don't want any foreigners there, whether they be Americans or anybody else, just as they fought against the Russians there. So this the trick now, and of course with the president announcing that the U.S. will be withdrawing its forces by 2014, is how quickly to get those forces out and what kind of security situation can you turn over to a new Afghan government.
Getting back to ricin for a moment, back in 2003, there were British and French operatives who discovered that there was ricin planned for the subways or for the transportation systems, right?
Yeah, there were these fleeting reports coming through that al-Qaeda was again toying with this idea. I mean, they're pretty creative in terms of the various options they're looking at. And so the trick is ricin is a volatile element. Again, as we pointed out, it's very subject to heat. There's other things. If you tied it with an explosive, would that, again, reduce its potency? But it's just as much the idea that you're going to be blowing up some kind of chemical poison that's going to scare the daylights out of people, as much as perhaps cause actual physical harm. It's the psychological terror that they're trying to instill as much as a physical blast as well.
And they do seem to follow certain kind of maps or game plans. I mean, the Trade Center, they tried it once, then they tried it again.
Right.
Ricin. Right. Surfacing once more.
Right. And, of course, with aviation. They continue to look at aviation. If you fact, again, going back to the affiliate in Yemen, one of its key plots was trying to put explosives and printer cartridges aboard cargo planes that would blow up somewhere either over the Atlantic on the way to Chicago. And what's interesting about that plot is, while it may, of course, have killed people in the plane or on the ground, what it did was, for what they claimed was only a cost of about $4,200, forced the whole global air cargo system to shut down for a couple of days and forced the international community to spend tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to revamp and secure that system. So for a very small investment, they're making an economic impact as well as perhaps any kind of physical impact of blowing up an aircraft.
Which is always what they wanted to do anyway.
That's right.
That was in the plans from the beginning. Let me go to Rockland and welcome George. George, you're on.
Yes, good morning. Very quickly, perhaps you saw a recent Frontline piece where a point was made that, and I take your point, it's a good one about the unprecedented cooperation between the agencies in getting bin Laden, but the point that they made vis-a-vis the huge expansion in the security apparatus within this country, that the bin Laden raid was still done by existing units, basically using existing opportunities and technologies and so forth. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on this huge expansion of the security apparatus within the country.
Well, The raid actually was carried out with technology that didn't exist on 9/11, surveillance drones and other equipment, and it existed. It took place with a kind of cooperation and training that hadn't been done before on 9/11. But the caller's right. I mean, there has been a tremendous growth in the budgets of the Defense Department, the intelligence community, Homeland Security, and the industry. And I think what's interesting now is the new Defense Secretary, Leon Panetta, one of his big tasks will, unlike his immediate predecessor, Bob Gates, will not be so much looking at the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, while those will still be important, but will be bringing down the budget of the Defense Department. And there'll be other pressures on all the other federal agencies to rein in their spending right now, as the country obviously is going through very hard economic times.
Let me thank the caller, and we go to Santa Rosa. Gregory, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah. Hi. For me, the day that bin Laden was assassinated was one of our greatest days of shame in the U.S. because it's the official policy of assassination now. But your guest sounds like an embedded reporter, and I haven't heard anything that's critical of present-day U.S. policy, so I'm having a lot of doubts about his credibility as anything but a cheerleader for the government military machine. So could your guest say something that would convince us he's not just an embedded reporter?
Well, thank you for the question, caller. I did point out that I think this government has been very poor and very weak on trying to combat one of the main elements of the ideology. This is what's actually enabling al-Qaeda, even in its weakened state, to continue to recruit young men, alien young men from around the Middle East and North Africa. The job that the administration is doing, this administration, the government is doing here in the United States, of coordinating between Homeland Security and the FBI to try and combat a small but growing threat of radicalized Americans, is quite poor and still relatively uncoordinated with the efforts on the ground. So I think, and the other thing finally is the president himself, while he has carried out more continuity than change from President Bush and certainly ramping up the drone strikes, I think he raised expectations in his well done Cairo speech, and has not effectively followed through with many of the concrete proposals that he and his staff talked about that will combat other elements of fighting extremism around the world. So there's lots of room for criticism of this administration.
Although after 9/11, there was a lot of criticism about the lack of coordination between FBI, CIA, and so forth, and your book suggests that some of that has really been surmounted in major ways.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, many of the barriers have been taken down, and especially the farther you get down on the ground, in the field, many of these, when you have FBI agents working alongside military, State Department people, secret organizations like the National Security Agency, which does all the eavesdropping, very good cooperation. It's when you pull back and maybe still get back into Washington, particularly now with budgets so tight, that the bureaucratic turf wars kick in and you still have some of the barriers.
There's also been some extraordinary advances in technology. I mean, the supercomputers and the ways of spying and ferreting out information and so forth.
Absolutely. The combination of the reconnaissance satellites and drones that pick up not only images but conversations off cell phones, off of emails, and be able to crunch all that information in a much more timely way, integrating information picked up from spies and informants on the ground. Still not perfect by any means, but much faster and able to then give policymakers and commanders the option. Do we put soldiers on the ground? Do we hit this target with a drone strike? Or perhaps do we bomb them with electrons? Do we go in electronically, as we were talking about before, and spoofing them within their cyber world to get the job done?
Harvested a lot of information from the Pakistan killing of bin Laden.
Yes, it was. Obviously, the major conclusions were that bin Laden himself was much more involved in the operational planning, but very frustrated in many ways that his subordinates, not only in Pakistan but in these affiliates, couldn't carry out the big attack against the United States that he wanted. Frustrated that they were on their heels in many places by the drone strikes or the finances drying up. And also that he's still very much removed from the day-to-day struggle on the ground in many of these countries.
Well, there is a sense of ongoing concern and the need for vigilance that comes across in your book, but there's also a lot of hope because you seem to be doing the job in terms of security without you sounding like a cheerleader. I mean, you really do present the case that there's been a lot of real yeoman work done.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us. Eric Schmidt, again, senior writer and terrorism national security correspondent of the New York Times. The book is Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. When we return, talk about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which begins to not be in effect today.